Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tonight, going to read from Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 9, the most confidential knowledge, text 10. If you know the Sanskrit, you can repeat after me. Mayadhyakshena prakriti. Suyate sacharacharam. Suyate sacharacharam. Hetunanena kaunteya, hetunanena kaunteya, jagat viparivartate, jagat viparivartate, maya, by me, adyakshena, by superintendence, prakriti, material nature, suyate, manifest. Sa, both. Chara, achara, the moving and the non-moving. Hetuna, for the reason. Anena, this. Kaunteya, O son of Kunti. Jagat, the cosmic manifestation. Viparavartate is working. So the translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. So Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is clearly stated here that the Supreme Lord, although aloof from all the activities of the material world, remains the Supreme Director. The Supreme Lord is the Supreme Will and the background of the material manifestation, but the management is being conducted by material nature. Krishna also states in Bhagavad Gita that of all the living entities in different forms and species, quote, I am the Father. The Father gives seeds to the womb of the mother for the child, and similarly, the Supreme Lord, by his mere glance, injects all the living entities into the womb of material nature, and they come out in different forms and species, according to their last desires and activities. All these living entities, although born under the glance of the Supreme Lord, take their different bodies according to their past deeds and desires. So the Lord is not directly attached to this material creation. He simply glances over material nature. Material nature is thus activated, and everything is created immediately. Because he glances over material nature, there is undoubtedly activity on the part of the Supreme Lord. But he has nothing to do with the manifestation of the material world directly. This example is given in the Smriti. When there is a fragrant flower before someone, the fragrance is touched by the smelling power of the person, yet the smelling and the flower are detached from one another. There is a similar connection between the material world and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually, he has nothing to do with this material world, but he creates by his glance and ordains. In summary, material nature, without the superintendence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, cannot do anything. Yet, the Supreme Personality is detached from all material activities. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I'm very happy to be back here in New Dwarka, the Hare Krishna temple here in Los Angeles. You know, a couple of weeks ago I was in Siberia as part of tour of Russia. And I rather prefer the weather here, but sometimes to carry out my service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I have to go to different places where, you know, the weather may not be to my liking, but that's not the most important thing. You know, the most important thing for all of us is to be somehow or other doing some service for the benefit of other living beings under the guidance of spiritual authorities for the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's the actual purpose of life. So sometimes to do that, you know, we may have to, you know, accept some condition that we might not choose for our own pleasure. But that's the nature of service. And really, all of us by nature are servants. You know, as Bob Dylan once said in one of his songs, everybody's got to serve somebody. So we should be trying to serve the person that's most deserving of service, and that person is the personality of Godhead. Sometimes people ask me, you know, when I'm speaking at universities or scientific conferences, they ask, well, what proof is there of God's existence? What I tell them is, you are proof of God's existence, because each of you, each one of you, is a conscious being. We wouldn't be having this conversation here. We wouldn't be speaking to each other if you weren't conscious and I weren't conscious. So consciousness is the fundamental aspect of our existence. And we notice that consciousness is individual and personal. I have my consciousness. You have your consciousness. So this suggests there's a source of all conscious beings. And that source must also, therefore, be conscious, individual, and personal. It's the most reasonable, logical, rational explanation for our own existence. We are conscious beings. This consciousness must have a source. Some people want to say, no, the source of consciousness is chemicals. But no one has ever been able to put chemicals together in such a way as to produce consciousness. That has never been done. And so consciousness is not the result of a combination of matter. It has an existence apart from matter. And it must have a source. And that source should also be conscious, personal, and individual, because that's the nature of consciousness. So I tell people, yes, you are the proof of God's existence. Because what is God? God is the supreme conscious being. And he has some connection with this world. There are those who want to think this world is just happening all by itself. Satyama pratishtam te jagat ahur anishwaram aparasparasam bhutam kimanyat kamahaitukam. In the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes a certain type of philosopher who thinks Matter is the only thing that exists. There is no soul. There is no God. Matter is the only thing that exists, and it just combines and combines and produces everything in that way, just automatically. But we never see that matter combines into anything really significant without the action of some kind of controller. Now, here it's being explained that that controller may not be immediately visible to us. Just like, I mean, you can see here, you know, we have some light, you know, coming from the lighting fixtures, you know, here in this temple. And you could say, well, what's the source of the light? You could say, well, it's electricity. But where is the electricity coming from? You know, if you trace the wires, you know, back, you know, to the power lines, and you trace the power lines back far enough, you'll come to a power generating station. And then when you go into that power generating station, you'll see there are engineers who are controlling it, who are generating the electricity, controlling its distribution. Now, they may not be visible here, because here, you know, we just see, oh, the lights are there. But if we trace it all the way back, even though we can't see them, we cannot see those engineers. But right now, at this very moment, there are engineers who are in the power plants generating and distributing the electricity that is making the light, you know, that we see here. And that's not the only thing. Say if we just sat here for a long, long time, and nobody bothered to pay the electricity bill, then we would see that eventually the lights would go out. Because there are certain laws. That's what I wanted to talk about, you know, tonight. Laws of the universe. So laws imply some lawmaker, and law implies, well, we have a choice either to follow the laws or not follow the laws. And if we follow them, there's some benefit. And if we don't follow them, there's some penalty that we have to undergo. So we see that in the case of the light. If we just sit here for a long, long time and then nobody pays the electricity bill, then the power will be cut off. Because there are controllers. There are laws. There are rules that have to be followed. So in the universe, it's a similar situation. We may not be able to directly see, you know, the controllers. Of course, if you really want to, it's possible. You know, Krishna describes how you can actually trace the source of control all the way back to its origin and actually see the controller. That's actually possible. But in order to do that, we have to accept a certain process. You know, Krishna says, Bhaktya mam abhijananti yavan yaschasmi tatvataha tato mam tatvato gyatva vishate tadanantaram. It is possible to see, you know, the supreme controller. But in order to do that, we have to satisfy him by performing a certain kind of yoga. There are different kinds of yoga that people like to practice these days. But the supreme yoga is the one that will take us, that will give us the vision of the supreme controller, the source of all conscious beings, the lawmaker of the universe. And that's possible. You know, if we take up, you know, the practice of, you know, devotional service, we can actually come to that position. But this lawmaker has arranged our universe in such a way that we must experience reactions to our activities. Just like in the purport to this verse, Srila Prabhupada is explaining that Krishna, the Supreme Lord, injects conscious selves into the material energy. Of course, we live in a multi-level cosmos. Yeah, this is something that many people don't realize today. You know, they think if you just start traveling from our Earth and going into outer space, you'll just find more space, more matter, more material energy. But in the Vedic literature, we learn that there's something beyond that. There are other levels, you know, to the cosmos. There are levels of the cosmos dominated by subtle mental energies, inhabited by beings. People have different names for these beings. In the Vedic tradition, we call them devas. Other people might call them angels or astral beings. And then beyond that, there's a level of pure consciousness or spirit, Brahman. And within that Brahman, there are abodes, there are dhams, there are spiritual planets that are inhabited by purely spiritual beings. And that's our original home. We originally come from there. But if we misuse our spiritual intelligence, if we misuse our spiritual free will, then, as we learn in this purport by Srila Prabhupada, we are injected by the glance of the Supreme Lord into the material energy, and then we have to take on different forms. And these forms, these bodies, are like vehicles for conscious selves. Ishvara sarva bhutanam hridesh arjuna tishtate brahmayan sarva bhutanam yantra rudani mayaya. So Krishna explains later in the Bhagavad Gita that these bodies are like machines for the conscious self, machines for the soul. And just, we're now in an alien element. You know, our real position is the spiritual level of reality. That's where we're meant to exist. But if we come to the realm of matter, then we need a vehicle to function here. It's like normally, as human beings, we're meant to exist on the land. And if we enter an alien element like water, you know, we need a vehicle in order to exist there. You know, we need a diving suit or a submarine or some kind of vehicle that will allow us to function on that level. So when the conscious self comes to the realm of matter, it needs a material vehicle for it to function here. So Krishna provides different kinds of bodies, which are vehicles for conscious selves. I was on a radio show last night. I was being interviewed, and one of the callers, you know, asked me a question. Well, okay, we're conscious selves. We're in these vehicles. We're in human vehicles now. Is it possible? Do you think that in the course of reincarnation that you just always come back to a human vehicle, a human body? And according to the Vedic philosophy, the answer is no. According to your level of consciousness, you can go into lower species of life. You know, there are 8,400,000 different species of life, some of them human, some of them plant, some of them animal, fish, insect. So it's possible that according to one's karma, one's activities and one's desire, as Srila Prabhupada says here, that one can take another form of life. But the conscious self in each body is actually the same. It's the same kind of conscious self that's in the body of a plant or an animal or a fish or an insect. And that seems strange to many people. They don't really understand how that can be. But and just like, you know, I'm a person, and I could ride on a bicycle, or I could ride on a motorcycle and go faster, or I could ride in a car, go still faster, or I could get in a boat and sail on a lake, or I could get in a submarine and I can go under the water, or I could get in an airplane and I could fly in the sky, or I could even, you know, get into a space capsule, go to the International Space Station and float around in space for a while. So I'm the same person, but according to the kind of vehicle I'm in, you know, I can act, you know, to a greater or lesser degree. So the conscious self and the body of a plant can't move because that's the nature of that vehicle. You know, a conscious self and the body of a bird, it can fly. So what's so special about the human vehicle? Because in one sense, you could just see it as another type of vehicle, because in all these different vehicles, you know, the conscious self is surviving somehow or other. It's getting nourishment. You know, it's defending itself. It's reproducing itself. It's resting sometimes, acting sometimes. You know, if you look at all the different species of life, you'll see that they share many activities, like most animals. They eat, they sleep, they mate, they defend. They do it in different ways. So what's so special about the human vehicle? The human vehicle is important because in the human form of life, we have the developed intelligence that will allow us to understand the actual laws of the universe. And it will allow us to properly act in such a way that we get the best result. Now, the best result is to transfer ourselves out of the material universe and go back to our original position on the spiritual level of reality. I was talking about that last night on this radio show. It was called Beyond Reality. I think it was out of Rhode Island somewhere. But we were talking about my book, Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And the interviewers, you know, they were asking me, well, what do you mean, you know, devolution? I said, well, by that I mean we don't evolve up from matter, you know, as the Darwinists now say, but rather we're originally spiritual beings who exist on some spiritual level of reality, and we devolve or come down from there to this material level of reality. And one of the interviewers, there were two of them, he said, well, is that really, you know, such a bad thing? I mean, you're making it seem like something bad, but couldn't it just be just like it, that's something we have to do, that we have to experience, and it's kind of good for us? And I said, well, take a look around. I mean, you know, what is going on in this world? There's so much violence and conflict on all levels. Conflict among individuals, conflict among classes, conflict among nations, even conflict among religions. It is not an altogether nice place, you know, if you haven't noticed. So, and also, you know, these vehicles that we come to inhabit, our human form of life even, it is still very uncomfortable. It's a very uncomfortable situation in which we find ourselves. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha dosha anudarshanam, the Gita says. An intelligent person will understand that this is not a pleasant place because we have to undergo birth, death, old age, disease again and again and again and again. Now, it's not to say there's no pleasure here. There obviously is. But there's a price, you know, to be paid for it, and that's one of the laws of the universe. That whatever we do in order to get, you know, material pleasure, we're going to have to experience some material pain to go along with it. That's just part of the deal. That's the law of the universe, one of the laws of the universe. So the special purpose of the human form is to allow us to elevate our consciousness, elevate ourselves, you know, back to the spiritual level of existence, where we eternally exist in loving harmony with all other conscious beings and with the source of all conscious beings, whom we know, you know, by the name Krishna, the all-attractive one. So that's the actual purpose of human life. Now, we should try to arrange our lives in such a way that we can put some of our time and energy into that. Just like all of you have made, you know, some very intelligent decisions about how to use your time. You've arranged your lives in such a way that you can spend some of your time coming, you know, to this center, which is a center for the elevation of consciousness. I mean, there's so many other places you could have gone, you know, this evening, but you very intelligently decided, well, this would be the best use of my time and energy this evening, you know, come to the Hare Krishna temple, which is not simply a, you know, just an ordinary sort of religious place, but it's an actual place, a center for the elevation of consciousness to its original state. And that's what we're actually meant to do. Atato Brahma Jigyasa, you know, the Vedanta Sutra says, the actual purpose of human life is to inquire about these spiritual topics and act in such a way as to make some progress in that direction. So, one of the laws of the universe is if you talk too much, your throat gets dry. So, and one of the other laws of the universe, if you talk too long, people start to get restless and bored. So, I'm not going to talk much longer. I'll just ask if any of you have any, you know, questions or comments, you know, that you'd like to make on this topic of laws of the universe or anything that I mentioned in the course of the talk. Does anybody have anything? Yes.
Just what's the Vedic perspective on cloning?
What is the Vedic perspective on cloning? So, actually, we have to understand that cloning is actually a natural process. For example, you could say, you know, whenever there's a birth of twins, identical twins, it's the result of a kind of a cloning process, because you get two, you know, identical individuals. Of course, we often see that they're not entirely identical, because according to the Vedic philosophy, there's more than just the bodies and, you know, the genes and things like that. There's the conscious self, and no two conscious selves are alike. You know, genetically, you know, the two bodies may be alike, but the conscious selves that enter them are different. So then we often see that even identical twins, although they may look somewhat alike, their personalities may be completely different. The other thing to realize is that, again, we have to go back to this idea that the conscious self is what makes a body alive. So even if you're able somehow or other to make another material form, it won't function unless a conscious self enters it and stays in there. So I thought it was very interesting. You know, I was reading some accounts of how the first cloned animal, the sheep Dolly, was made. So the scientists who were, I think, working in a lab in Scotland, they tried 300 times before they were actually able to get Dolly. And I thought that was interesting. I thought, well, what was going on there? They were, of course, it's a very complicated process how scientists, biologists today try to do these clonings, you know, that involves, you know, taking, you know, an egg and putting a new set of genes into it so that it produces an exact duplicate of the parent set of genes. Because in normal reproduction, you get half of the genetic material from the father, half from the mother, and that's why the offspring are different. So to get an individual that's an exact copy of a single parent, what you have to do is you have to take its complete genetic material and insert it, you know, take and insert it into a viable egg, and then let it just produce an exact copy of that genetic material. So it's not the result of any normal, you know, process of reproduction where you get half the genetic material from the mother, half from the father, and you get offspring that are different from both the mother and the father, although they might have some of their characteristics. So it's actually quite a difficult process in order to get this to work. And to get the first sheep, Dolly, they had to try 300 times. So what was going on there? From the Vedic perspective, I think it was something like this. They tried the first time, and Krishna didn't put a soul in there, so it wouldn't function. It wouldn't grow into a mature sheep. Or if it did, you know, maybe Krishna left the soul there for a little while, then took it out, and then, you know, before it became, you know, a fully viable sheep, you know, it died. So either it wouldn't work or it died. So I think what was happening is something like this. It's a speculation, but you can take it or leave it. But they tried the first time. Krishna put a soul there. Didn't put a soul there, so it didn't work. They tried a second time. Krishna didn't put a soul there. Didn't work. They tried a third time, a fourth time, a fifth time. And Krishna's thinking, these guys are really determined. I mean, I think that's one thing that we have to admire about material scientists who may be atheists or whatever. They've got a lot of determination. Yeah, which is, you have to admire it. So they try 5 times, 6 times, 10 times, 20 times, 30 times, 40 times, 100 times. It's not working, because Krishna's not putting a soul there. So then 200 times, 250 times, 300 times, Krishna finally says, okay, you want it so bad? Here, I'll give it to you. And Krishna puts a soul there, keeps it in there, in the embryo, until it develops into a fully functioning sheep, Dolly, and they have it. Now, it's interesting that, you know, if we look in the Vedic literature, we see accounts of things that sort of resemble cloning, not exactly what scientists today are doing, but, you know, if we look at the account of the birth of the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra, if we go to the Mahabharata, for example, Gandhari, wife of Dhritarashtra, was pregnant, but she had a miscarriage. And then we learned that the sage Vyasadeva divided that embryo into 100 pieces. Krishna caused 100 souls to enter, you know, the 100 pieces, and then you got the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra being born. There's another, you know, instance in one of the Puranas, the Bhagavat Purana, or Srimad Bhagavatam, where there was a demigoddess, Aditi, or Aditi, and she was pregnant with an embryo who was going to be a rival of the demigod Indra. So Indra found out about this. He entered the womb, cut the embryo into 7 pieces, then cut each piece into 7 more pieces. And then by Krishna's arrangement, Krishna caused souls to enter each of those 49 pieces of the embryo, and they turned into the 49 Maruts, you know, another group of demigods. So anyway, so those are some thoughts on cloning. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Time for the feast. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Yes.
And I have a question in the book.
Okay. Forbidden Archaeology. They have them at the gift shop here. It isn't major bookstores. It isn't major bookstores. Yeah, you have to ask. It may not be on a particular shelf, but it's in their systems. They can order it for you. It's also available through Amazon.com. Forbidden Archaeology. Okay, well, thank you. All right. So, but you're going to San Francisco, right? Okay. Yeah. Is that where you live? You live there? Okay. All right. I'll be fine. Well, that's good to know. It's good to know. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. How you doing?
Question about they transplant the genetic material into another cell. But isn't it true that Prabhupada writes like the cell already contains the soul that the individual cells even in our body are subordinate to another?